The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is Cameron Luthy. Cameron is a senior budget analyst at Bloomberg Government. And Cameron, welcome to the show once again.
Great to be with you again, Roger.
I'm looking forward to the conversation. We're at the silly season. I mean, and it's a confluence of two sort of things, right? We've got the end of year spend and everybody's trying to make obligations with their bona fide needs and spend that money before the end of fiscal year. But we've also got a new fiscal year coming. And once again, it seems like it's Groundhog Day. We're talking, all my cliches are coming out. we're talking about shutdown potentially again. And what I thought today maybe we could start out with is a little bit of a appropriations 101 or budget 101 or both, since they're both.
Yeah.
So first, let's just start from the very beginning in terms of a shutdown. What is a shutdown?
So a shutdown is when the Congress and the president are unable to reach agreement on providing funding in one form or another, and we'll get into the various forms that can take in a little bit. At the start of the fiscal year, or for that matter, you could have a shutdown later this fall. It's not something people haven't talked about a lot. Remember, the federal fiscal year starts October 1, which is fast approaching.
Right. And so when one of the things that I used to have to deal with, and I think is at the core of this, from a legal perspective, when I was in government, the Anti-Deficiency Act, right? You can't spend money that you don't have. And it has to be for actual bona fide need of government.
Right, and you can't spend it for things other than which it was appropriated. So, yeah.
And that's essentially the key, no money, no spending.
Right.
Right, okay.
Historically, the big joke when I was in the government was nobody's gone to jail for screwing that up yet.
Right.
but there have been some forced retirements, shall we say.
Yes, folks who have had to move on to other careers, let's say. So how often or how common are shutdowns? It seems like every year we're talking about them, in this century or at least in the last decade or so. How common are they really?
So the last shutdown, as everybody remembers, was in 2013. It lasted 16 days. It was enormously harmful to contractors doing business with the federal government, disrupted to federal government operations. But it was the first shutdown since the mid-90s in the Clinton years when both of us were around. I just had a birthday on Saturday. I am now 59, Roger. Can you believe that?
You said that on the radio,
yeah,
Cameron?
I know.
You're a braver man than me.
My wife says, be quiet.
Right, right, right.
But yeah, we had a shutdown event wrapped up also in a snowstorm in the mid-90s, one in the fall and then another in the late winter. It was very messy, very disruptive, in the interim, of course, and since 2013, you're right. Every year the talk comes up. Will they find a way to reach agreement on spending? And the reason for that is, as you and everybody who's listening knows, Congress rarely finishes the appropriations bills on time. So that means you're heading.
Don't we mean never?
Yeah. Okay.
Right. You're being kind.
Right. Now if you go back to, the mid-aughts, if you will, they did get defense done, I think, in the middle of that decade, and DHS and MILCON and then left everything else hanging for several months. But yeah, the norm is continuing resolutions. Absolutely right.
Okay, so in the context of a shutdown, and I mean, you mentioned, I think there's been about four or five, I think, overall in the last 30 years, but the one I remember distinctly, other than the most recent one, is in the 90s, because I was a federal employee at that time.
Me too.
And there were points in time where certain people could do things, could actually continue to work, and then other folks were basically directed, do not show up to work, because it would be that, you know, creating an unfunded obligation to pay those folks, anti-deficiency act kind of thing. So, and I actually worked in an organization where some people, I mean, literally some people in the same office came in, other people were not allowed to come in. Can you talk a little bit about some of the rules around what kind of work continues or can continue and what must stop?
The legal interpretations are that only work that is necessary to protect life and property is supposed to go on. That's why so many federal workers end up being sent home, and only a small percentage are deemed quote-unquote essential and show up to work, not being paid, at least, you know, up front, when they do come into work. So in one of the shutdowns in the 90s, I was essential, and I think in the second one, I was not.
That sounds like a good career path.
Yeah, you know, from being essential, I was going downhill, right? But if you look at it historically, presidents have been able to exempt large numbers of federal workers. And if you recall, in 2013, Congress was trying to mitigate the impact of shutdown by passing one-off pieces of legislation to send certain select groups of federal employees back to work by providing a funding measure, because they, you know, you literally had a hearing where I think it was on the House side, where they were berating the head of the of FAA, saying, you didn't tell us that you would shut down and, you know, send the air traffic controllers home and blah blah blah. And he said, actually, I did, in a hearing on such and such a date, you know. So there was this embarrassment, if you will.
Right. So, one of the things that sort of, you know, strikes me too, and then I know folks, you mentioned like people get furloughed. The question is, do they end up getting paid? In most cases, doesn't Congress enact sort of retroactive? Is that the way it usually works?
Yeah. There's in recent years, there's been some squabbling about it, but in the end, Congress, I think out of embarrassment, agrees to pay those federal workers even though they were sent home.
Right. Well, in the case of contractors, isn't it? Usually, when there's no money, they get stop work orders, or what typically happens from your perspective?
It depends on very much on the individual contract. You have to know whether or not the funds were already obligated, whether the work was ongoing, whether or not it requires government supervision. So, you know, if the government's office is shut down and all the federal workers are home, and your contract is staff augmentation, where you have 20 people with green badges sitting next to those with blue badges, guess what? Your people are going to have to go home, and you've got to figure out how to deal with that.
Right. You got to think, you know, are you paying those people? I assume you are, to keep them on staff, obviously.
Do you ask them to take vacation days? Do you, you know, and this is the kind of thing that companies need to go through contract by contract and plan ahead of time. You don't want to be caught at the last minute trying to figure this out.
Right. Well, and part of that, too, is talking to your contracting officers, making
Absolutely.
Sure you understand exactly what type of contract you have, whether it's going to continue or not continue. So there's some basics there we just went through, Cameron. We're getting close to the end of the first segment, but maybe we can start a little bit. So what is the status? I mean, there's a lot of talk about continuing resolutions, whether there's going to be agreement or not agreement between the House and the Senate before to get some appropriations or whatever, or a continuing resolution to the president. What's just sort of real quickly, and then we get more in depth in the next segment, what's the state of play right now?
The state of play, I think the simplest way to put it is the House Republican caucus is divided amongst themselves. There's not agreement on whether or not to do a continuing resolution amongst House Republicans. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in the Senate says no shutdown, not going to do it. Boehner has a much harder job managing his own caucus. So that's where we are right now.
Okay. And on that note, we'll get into some of the details of the budget, talk about where the money's going a little bit, and just get into this dispute within the House and what that and implications of that are when we come back. My guest today is Cameron Luthy. He's a senior budget analyst at Bloomberg Government, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Cameron Luthy. Cameron is a senior budget analyst at Bloomberg Government, and we're talking about the shutdown, the machinations on the Hill in terms of the budget or continuing resolutions, to be more accurate, I think, at this point, and some of the appropriations bills. So, Cameron, at the end of last segment, you talked about, you know, the dispute in the House. Can you provide a little bit more detail, or get into, you know, the players and what's going on there that's sort of driving this issue, continuing resolution or not?
So clearly, Speaker Boehner has a tough job on his hands, and I think a lot of people criticize him by comparing him to great speakers of the House in history, and I think that's completely unfair because he doesn't have the same tools. Look, you can run for Congress spending your own money now. You don't need the party. There's no earmarks on appropriations bills, so there's no incentives that easily come to mind for the Speaker.
Right. Right. Well, earmarks some political thinkers think that they are actually not, in retrospect, aren't necessarily a bad thing because it actually helps, you know, sort of move things, the machinery of politics,
right,
along.
Politics is the art of the possible. The thing that people just didn't understand, sure, there were some earmarks that were wasteful money, wasteful spending, absolutely, no question about it. But it sort of, you know, was throw the bathwater out with the baby. It's important for people to understand that earmarks never added to the deficit. They were just Congress deciding where to spend it instead of the White House.
Right, right. And well, the other thing too is, you know, you mentioned sort of the people running in the role of the party. I mean, these days, like in so many different districts, right, it's really, the election really takes place in the primary, right?
That's what counts.
Right, and whether it's a liberal district and whether you're more liberal or less liberal, or in a conservative district and you're either more conservative or less conservative, and that's sort of what drives a lot of this, and sort of independence, I guess, sort of streak, especially in the Republican caucus, at least with the conservative.
Yeah, it's you know, the old joke was that from Will Rogers, I don't belong to any organized party, I'm a Democrat. Well, you know, the shoe's a bit on the other foot now. And I deliberately brought up the politics because it's very complicated. There are 30 plus members of on the House side who are opposed to moving ahead with a clean CR without a lot of policy riders, specifically over the issue of Planned Parenthood. And there are probably quite another couple of score who would probably go along with that, depending on how the politics of the moment are perceived. And remember, the presidential race has already started. You have 5 members of the United States Senate running for president. So the political atmosphere makes it harder to reach a deal.
Right. Well, okay. So on the House side, that being the case, is this a situation where the Republican leadership are going? I was reading an article, I think, this past weekend about the Democrats' choice in the House. Do they support the CR or not? And what does it mean for the Speaker's long-term prospects? I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, it won't be, if that's the scenario that plays out. In other words, if in order to pass a CR that is acceptable to the White House, the Speaker of the House needs Democratic votes, that won't be the first time he's had to do that.
Right.
And it didn't cost him his speakership in the past, despite dire prophecies. And there's no clear alternative to Speaker Boehner. And there are a lot of people who are loyal to him. So I think that the idea that they're going to be able to oust him as Speaker, I think, is a stretch.
Right. So on the House side, it really does boil down to this Planned Parenthood issue, in your opinion?
Yeah. I mean, there are a number of other issues. There are issues pertaining to policy writers for federal agencies saying things like, thou shalt not use any of the money for X, Y, and Z, EPA, for example, right?
Right, sure.
There are budget cuts to the IRS that have been put in the House version of the Financial Services Appropriations Bill that are, you know, different from the spending levels in the Senate bill. There are big policy disagreements between the White House and Congress over how much to put in the war spending bucket, We talked about that earlier this year, I think. In the president's budget, he asked for an increase of about $38 billion more than the caps allow for both defense and non-defense. Well, the House and Senate said, yeah, we like that idea of more money for defense, but we're not going to raise the caps. We're just going to put the extra money in the war budget. The White House is very unhappy about that. So there are a lot of other issues besides the Planned Parenthood issue.
So why is the White House unhappy about that?
Well, the Pentagon's argument is that war spending is transitory in nature. It isn't enduring.
It's not an investment, so
right,
to speak, right?
Right.
In future capability.
And you know, the spending caps are flat from 2014 to 2015 to 2016. They're flat. And the Pentagon can't fit their size 10 shoe, all their acquisition programs, in, or ten size 10
that,
foot
I mean,
into
I,
the
that's
size
a little,
9
that's a little
shoe.
Small. That's a little small.
Yeah, okay.
And especially for the Department of Defense.
14 triple E. What, you know.
Well, I'm thinking like Bob Lanier. Like, I think he was size
22.
Yeah. Size 22.
One of the greatest feats in sports.
Yeah, that's right.
So if you put it in the base budget and then you have an out, you know, acquisition programs have a multi-year nature to them and you can see the plan and how it's going to proceed and, you know, the acquisition strategy and so on and so forth. But if you're doing this in a one-off way, it's not conducive to a smooth process for the Pentagon.
Okay. So, I mean, I'm getting back to the, you know, to
right.
the issue of the disagreement. So you have that change as well as one of a policy change. Are there any other ones? You mentioned the IRS. Are there any other ones on the table?
Yeah, there are a couple. I think they're a bit desperate, grasping at straws, so to speak. One of them is trying to use the appropriations process, a CR, to somehow prevent any funding for implementing the deal with the multilateral agreement
with Iran.
Right?
Okay, yeah.
So that's obviously a very sensitive issue to a lot of people in Congress and generates a lot of emotion, shall we say.
So, right, and that's one like that I would assume would be, I mean, the dynamics of it are kind of interesting, right? Because let's say that was something that was in one of these, would probably come from the House, right? I mean,
right.
The Senate's not going to agree because, you know, they don't have the votes
right.
to do it. So the House, but then to get that out of the House, you need the, Boehner would need the Democrats potentially on, with regard to the vote, unless, the Planned Parenthood thing is also addressed, and then it just becomes a straight party vote, right? I mean, it's just there's so many different moving parts.
You're on the right track, Roger. I think one scenario that you could see is the House passes a bill with a Republican majority that is unacceptable to the White House and goes nowhere in the Senate. Now, that could give Republicans the chance to in the House to express their will, how
right.
they feel on the issues. But it's not a scenario that leads to a result by itself that keeps the government open and operating.
Right.
So you could see, for example, a scenario where that bill goes over to the House, it dies, but the Senate does something and sends it over to the House, and then the House sort of has to, you know, the Speaker, as we talked about before, reaches out to the
right.
Minority Leader Pelosi and says, I need your help. I need you guys to
right.
vote for
so,
this.
So the House Republicans can make a political statement initially, and then something gets worked out. But we'll talk more about reconciliation of this, all these issues in a couple segments. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about what some of the numbers are in the budget, what they look like, what the continuing resolution might look like. My guest today is Cameron Luthy. He's a senior budget analyst at Bloomberg Government, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Cameron Luthy. Cameron is a senior budget analyst at Bloomberg Government, and we're talking appropriation, shutdown, continuing resolution. It's that silly time of year once again. And we'll also touch a little bit on, you know, the end of fiscal year, what this past fiscal year has looked like from a spending perspective, or, you know, a procurement spend perspective in particular. But, you know, Cameron, this segment, I just wanted to start off and give you a chance to talk about big picture sort of what you see in the numbers and where there may be the disagreements or what and or what the impact of a continuing resolution would be on certain plans. You touched a little bit on, you know, the where the money was going with regard to whether it was going to go in the war spending category or, you know, be part of the DOD budget and the implications of that. But I'm just going to let it you open up. You can talk a little bit about the overall pictures from a numbers perspective.
So if you start at the macro level, discretionary spending, that is spending that is appropriated annually by Congress, and that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about mandatory spending. We're not talking about your Social Security check or your Medicare payments or Medicaid support. We're not talking about the temporary assistance to needy families. We're talking about annual appropriations to keep federal governments open, pay their workers, and hire contractors to do work for the federal government. So it's a $1 trillion budget on that discretionary side. It's roughly half and half between the defense function and the rest of the federal agencies. The defense function includes not just DOD, but also big chunks of the Department of Energy and smaller pieces of several other agencies, including the FBI, and there's defense spending buried in parts of Homeland Security and so on and so forth.
Okay. Well, what, you know, when you look at a continuing resolution and what the parameters of that, is it, you know, just leaving it at 2015 spending levels or what?
Yeah, that's a perfect question. So what we anticipate, and typically CRs take this form, continuing resolutions typically freeze spending at the previous year's levels. So in this case, it would freeze spending at 2015 levels as we start 2016. But it's more complicated than that. A continuing resolution says you can obligate at the current rate for the same type of activities and programs. So that means that if you were buying, I don't know, 3 airplanes a year or something along those lines, you couldn't increase the rate. So that's a problem if that was in the plan for 2016. Similarly, generally speaking, no new starts are allowed. So if you did something in 2015, but you wanted to do something new in 2016, it's stuck.
Right, until
you get full year funding. And to be clear about that, and I clarified this during the last shutdown, or it may have been, oh yeah, you remember one year when the Congress passed a hybrid appropriations bill where some agencies were funded for the
yes.
full year
yeah.
and some were under a continuing resolution for the rest of the year.
Right.
So and even within those that were on a full year CR, there were exceptions carved out where they said, you know, notwithstanding the formula of the CR, this part of DOE gets X amount of money, right? So
right.
yeah, it can really get messy, but absolutely complicated and problematic for industry, because if your office is, your program is under a CR, no new starts and no increase in the rate of service.
So with no new starts, and you're really talking about, you know, I guess options being exercised to the extent you have money, you know, they're part of the plan, or modifications to existing work rather than completely new work. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and particularly important under a CR is multiple award contracts. As you know, multiple award contracting has become more and more prevalent in the federal space, and we're over 20% now. A new task order under a multiple award contract most likely would not count as a new start.
Okay, that's interesting.
So that's really important, you know, as companies go through their existing contracts to see where they're vulnerable in under a CR and where they're able to maybe take advantage of that and get increased revenue through new task orders.
Okay, so yeah, okay, so it's more viewed as an ongoing sort of contract administration. I got to place a new order for the same work that I have to continue, or something
right,
like that.
Right, because you know how big the scope of work is on some of these multiple award contracts, so there's lots of room there to execute and to issue new RFPs, new task orders.
So I have something sort of bothered me, I guess, or not really bothered me, just my curiosity is, like, we keep talking about shutdown and continuing resolutions. We don't talk seem to be about sequestration anymore. You know, and I guess you have Ryan Murray, that the deal that was cut was last year or 2 years ago?
A couple years back now.
Yeah. So why doesn't the term sequestration come up? Are we past that fight? Now we're on to either we shut down or we don't? What's the deal?
Great question. So the thing that people have to remember is that the Budget Control Act of 2011 had multiple features in it. It cut all kinds of spending in different creative ways. And one of the ways it cut spending was to set a series of spending caps. The other, another way that it was intended to cut spending was it basically set a target for Congress. You know, they set it for themselves to cut $1 trillion and change over a 10-year period, and they could do that by increasing revenues. They could reduce the deficit by reducing spending. So they had this option. They couldn't reach an agreement, and as a consequence, those spending caps got lowered. And 2013, we saw a sequester across the board cuts.
Right.
But those lower caps are what control today. Even, you know, as we talked about, they were adjusted for 2014 and 2015 in the Ryan Murray deal, but they're the controlling factor. The only way we'd see sequester again is if Congress passed bills that exceeded the caps and the president signed them into law. Then you'd see an across-the-board cut. But nobody, that doesn't seem likely.
Doesn't even seem logical, though, either. No. It's like you exceed the caps, he signs a bill, but then it turns into you have to cut.
Yeah. There's one logic to it is then you, as a member of Congress, can say, well, I didn't agree to cutting this agency or that agency individual. It was out of my hands.
Right. Okay.
But that's not what we're talking about. You're absolutely right. We're talking about the caps and whether they do a deal on a CR or they don't, and the government shuts down.
Well, from a practical perspective, does a CR really reduce spending, or does for example, does the slowing down of spending actually result in cuts in and of itself? I mean, I know there's an interesting article that Bloomberg did about the budget impasse might, you know, stall $46 billion in defense spending. Is that due to the shutdown or the CR, just keeping it at lower levels so there isn't that increase I'm searching for my question, but I'm trying to understand the role of CRs in terms of cutting spending as opposed to capping spending.
So if you think about a CR as a straight line from the 2015 level, it's not a cut. It's just it may stop spending from happening that would have been new in 2016. It may lock you into having money in a bucket where you don't want it. Let's say the program was done in 2015. Now you got the money sitting there and you don't need it. Whereas the program you'd like to start in 2016, you can't. So CRs are very blunt instruments, if you will. They're basically not, it's not about cutting spending, it's about keeping the government open and operating.
Right, but that has a practical impact,
oh, yeah,
right, of reducing spending or slowing the rate of increase over
absolutely
time.
Absolutely, on individual programs. So in aggregate, no. In when it get to the individual programs, the Pentagon has a whole bunch of programs that would have been either increased the rate of procurement or introduce a new program, a new acquisition. So, for example, the Army just awarded that contract to Oshkosh for the Joint Light Tactical Vehicle, the replacement for the Humvees.
Yep.
And
LTV, yep.
They're not, you know, they're nowhere close to full rate production. They're nowhere close to the production level they planned for 2016. So whatever production level they achieved this year in the last month of the year, I mean, that contract was just let in August. So you know that that's going to handicap that production rate in the first quarter, maybe the second quarter, depending, sure, on how long the CR lasts. The Air Force had a list of 50 programs. A lot of them are smaller, but 50 programs.
Hold that thought,
right?
Cameron. We'll talk about those 50 programs when we come back from the break. My guest today is Cameron Luthy. He's a senior budget analyst at Bloomberg Government. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Cameron Luthy. He is a senior budget analyst at Bloomberg Government. And Cameron, when we took the break, I had to stop you. We talked about like 50 programs or line items from the Air Force budget proposed. You were going to address those?
Yeah, real quick. There are, as the Air Force said, there are about 50 programs that are potentially going to be impacted if there is a continuing resolution. And of course, some of this depends on when the Air Force had planned to let the contract or do the mod to the contract. And certainly the other services are also in a similar jam. And there will be programs in the civil agencies as well that, you know, because of a CR, they won't be able to launch a new program or increase the rate of activity. The Air Force programs include everything from operation and maintenance, military construction, and some big acquisition programs. An example is the KC-46 tanker, the aerial refueling tanker.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Brigadier General Duke Richardson, the head of the Air Force's tanker program, told the Air Force Association, you know, at their conference last week, he said CR would create a very large problem for the program that could lead the Air Force to break its contract with Boeing, which is building the aircraft. And the current contract is very favorable to the government.
Yes.
Remember, there was that amazing competition between Boeing and Airbus.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, the government got a pretty good deal. So they don't want to break that contract and have the Boeing get a chance to renegotiate.
Sure. So there's that aspect of it. So it's like a ripple effect, really,
mm-hmm.
right? When you think about continuing resolutions. So I got two questions for you before we turn to talking a little bit about the current fiscal year and what you've seen. Like, number one, what do contractors need to think about? And number two, how does this all get resolved? So from, you can take them whichever order you want. But
well, I think that starting with what contractors ought to be doing right now, you obviously, the bigger the company, the more resources you have. But you really need to pull together a cross-functional team. You need to have people from HR to address the personnel issues that we raised earlier, right? Are people going to be furloughed? You need your contracts office to look at the contract review, review the contracts, I should say, to see where work would continue under a CR, where it would be hampered under a CR, and under a shutdown. So you need to do some scenario-based planning. And it's, you have to have the lawyers in the room, right? You got to have everybody at the table.
Damn lawyers, right?
Somebody across the table from me, right?
Yeah, right. That's what, there's always a job for us, right?
That's right. So it really is incumbent on companies to pull together across teams and sit down and plan out the scenarios. Okay, if this happens, how does it affect the business?
Right. Okay. That's great advice. Now, the second question, how do you see this getting resolved from so we can have a nice holiday season?
Well, if history is any teacher to us.
And I include Halloween in that, too.
Well, you know, that might be a bit early.
Okay.
The lessons of the past are that eventually reasonable people can sit down and reach an agreement between the Congress and amongst the Congress and the White House and find a way to fund the government for the rest of the year. It is an election year next year, so there is an incentive to get this done before the holidays so that it doesn't carry over into next year, because it doesn't get easier to reach agreement on funding levels. It gets harder. So I think that ultimately, a deal will look similar to what was reached in 2013 by then chairman of the budget committees, Patty Murray in the Senate and Paul Ryan in the House, a deal that increases spending some, not as much as the president would like. It increases spending equally for defense and non-defense, despite the Republicans not being happy about that. Maybe offset that unhappiness by increasing war spending more than the president asked for, and you can make a rational argument that operations against ISIS were not fully anticipated back in February when the president's budget came out. And that deal, though, has to include some offsets, because that's the historical pattern, is that any deal to increase discretionary spending has to be paid
away.
For,
yeah.
Right? So that is going to be very difficult to reach. in part because some of the things that people have talked about as ways to pay for increased discretionary spending overall are also being discussed in the context of other types of legislation, like reauthorizing the highway trust fund and highway spending. That's been a decade of no agreement on no way to increase the financing because there is no agreement to raise the gas tax, so it holds back highway spending. And unless they can find some other offset, like taxing overseas,
you hesitate when you say that.
Taxing profits that are held overseas and things like that. So you may have more than one claimant on the pay fors, if you see what I mean.
Sure.
And there are people in Congress who really want to do comprehensive tax reform, particularly on the corporate side, which I think a lot of our audience is very interested in. So you don't want to use the things that might help keep a corporate tax reform revenue neutral and use it necessarily for increased spending on the discretionary side. But there are other ways to pay for it.
Right. Do you see that? I mean, just an aside question, is the comprehensive tax reform part of an overall deal to try to address the budget, from a long-term perspective, or just is it just one piece of the puzzle that would be done first or second or whatever?
Our tax experts tell me that it takes a long time to do tax reform because of the complexities, all the different loopholes, and you got oil depreciation allowance and all these things that, so I don't see that as being part of the end game this fall.
Okay. So turning to the current fiscal year and the profile of spending, you have some nuggets for the audience out there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little early to be certain. Obviously, the 90-day lag in reporting of defense obligations handicaps analysis at this point, but all signs point to a very active fourth quarter in federal contracting. Obligation rates we expect will be high in the fourth quarter, as they typically are, and we expect business to have lots of fun scrambling at the last minute to get funds, get contracts signed. The contract officers and the contract offices at the companies are going to be, working long hours like they always are at the end of the year. But we see,
which is next week.
Yeah, right. But all signs point to a year as good as, if not better than, last year in total obligations.
Right. And are those, do you see those, the explosion or the growth, not the explosion, the continuing growth of multiple award contracts and placing orders off that, is that one of the driving tools that people are using these days?
Yeah. I mean, it's very convenient for the government. I think that trend will continue. I think the increase in small business prime obligations will continue to increase. Remember, last year the government hit its overall targets for 2014, though obviously not every agency did so.
Right, right. Some much less than that.
And some by design. I mean, DOE, most of their money goes to the labs, and the small businesses can't do that work.
Sure. Cameron, thank you so much. So yes or no, are we going to have a shutdown or not? I put you on the spot.
I'll say if it happens, it will be short.
Okay.
Not like 2013.
Okay.
But I'm holding out hope for a deal.
Okay, great. I want to thank my guest today, Cameron Luthy. He is a senior budget analyst with Bloomberg Government, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.